Hello, and welcome to the 41st episode of Unlimited Opinions. This is also the last episode for Season 1. I'm Adam Bishop.
I'm Mark Bishop.
And as always, we're reading Anthony Kenny's A New History of Western Philosophy, and this is the last chapter in the book, God in the Modern Era of Philosophy.
Would God know how many seasons we will have?
I would say yes.
Does God now know?
You would say no.
Does God now know how many seasons we're going to have?
Well, yes, and he always has, and he always will.
Always will what?
Always will know that. I think we've...
What if I quit right now?
Well, then he knew that.
He knew that already. Yes. Yeah, that's a bunch of baloney. He doesn't know what I'm gonna do any more than I do.
Okay.
He knows what I've done. Or she, whatever the case may be.
All right, are we ready to start actually discussing the...
We aren't talking about God.
Well, I know, but are we going to discuss the philosophers? Are you just going to yell at me about this some more?
I'm done. All right, let's go.
All right.
So we're following the book of history of Western philosophy.
Yes, I believe I explicitly stated that.
I have to give credit for it. I think we missed a couple of those.
We might have. It's always in the podcast description.
Oh, that's okay.
Yes.
So for season two, we have to figure out a way to get an interview with Anthony.
Anthony Kenny.
Yeah, maybe we should do like an interview show or something.
We could.
Well, maybe we could talk about that at the end of this episode.
Yeah. You can tweet at us if you want to be interviewed. That's the new prize.
No, I'm not agreeing to that.
Not acceptable.
No, that is unacceptable. Most people. Well, that's not true. I think if you given enough time, interviewing anybody can result in a fascinating story.
Yeah.
It could be a tragedy. It could be a romantic story. But when you really talk to people, you can find a good story anywhere.
Yeah.
From anybody. Even if it's just somebody who has the most mundane life ever.
Mm-hmm.
That can be told in a fascinating way. And I found that, you know, in all the thousands and thousands of people I've met in my career as an attorney, that everybody has a story. That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not be a hero, but anyway, sorry, I digress.
That was very interesting. So starting off with faith versus alienation. And so we start off here with Ludwig Feuerbach, and he kind of introduces this sort of idea that becomes very prominent in a lot of these philosophers. Mm-hmm. And he says that God is just a projection of the human mind. So God doesn't really exist. And with that, he says that, you know, man is just part of nature. And, you know, the only reason he ever created a monotheistic God is when he became conscious of possessing reason, will, and love. So it's really just our innate intelligence that led us to kind of create God. God did not create our intelligence.
I think that's the best argument against God.
You think so?
I do. Mm-hmm. Don't you? What do you think is a better argument against God?
I don't think there is one. I think you're right.
Well, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would say that, you know, yeah, especially when you go into like the proofs for God's existence, if you try to just, you know, go the route of just trying to disprove those,
right,
then you just kind of get muddled, I think, really in the details and everything.
Right.
But, you know, putting it like this, you know, who's to say, you know, God isn't just a creation of us, you know,
right.
You know, we're intelligent, we're reasonable, you know, we love. Why wouldn't we project that onto some sort of higher being?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. The ideal and just assume that it exists or try to presume that it exists.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good.
So then your favorite philosopher next has an opinion about this, Karl Marx. He says that...
I don't consider him a philosopher.
Yeah, he's really an economist.
I think he's just an ass.
Well, yeah, that too.
and he hates humanity. I think he has the suffers from the miserable person complex, where they are miserable and they just... That imbues their entire... life, philosophy, and attitude towards existence with a hatred, and he's just despicable. But go ahead.
I agree with you. So Marx says that religion is the opium of the masses, and the reason we even have religion at all is because we invented it as a way to basically make labor bearable.
Right.
You know, we kind of, you know, created this God as, you know, eventually we'll get to a place where we don't have to work and that sort of thing, and he kind of blames capitalism and, you know, the class difference on kind of the creation of a God.
And you know, he's brilliant in his description of religion and the fight between capital and labor and all that, because I really view his beliefs as more of a religious belief than a real practical philosophy. And this is a pretty good explanation of why, a negative explanation of why religions exist, especially, you know, more formal religious structures that are really part state, part religion. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just to try to keep the people pacified, like opium in China back before, what was the war they had? Is it a Boxer Rebellion? Is it?
I do not know. I don't know much about the history of China.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, that you're they. I'll make a prediction. By the time this airs, China will have invaded Taiwan.
And he's making this prediction on August 17th.
August 17th. Yes. So I think we're going to be like 4 weeks out, maybe.
4 weeks. Yeah. So, it'll be like mid-September by the time this comes out.
Yeah. And so, anyway, I don't want really to get into that whole thing, but they're moving on it because of the mess in Afghanistan. They realized there's no leadership in the United States, and we don't have the stomach for war. And they are absolutely, in my opinion, going to invade Taiwan in the next 30 days.
That's very bleak.
They've converted their ferries. You know, they use ferries to go across, you know, bodies of water. They've converted them to military use surreptitiously.
Huh. That's worrying.
Yeah, I'd be worried if I was in Taiwan. We're the Chinese. We're just coming over for a visit in our militarized troop ferries. I don't mean ferries in a politically incorrect term about other people.
Yes.
So
a digression there.
But the opiate reference was a prominent reference at the time Marx lived because...
Yeah, I know about the opium.
Because they would have the opium dens, and it was just, you know, it's just like opium now, but there was such widespread use in China that the British were able to just walk in and take all the resources and just subjugate, I don't know how many millions of people they had there that were just a lot, and so many of them were incapacitated just from opiate addiction.
Yeah.
Terrible, sad. Yep.
It's interesting, though, that you kind of say that, like, Marxist beliefs were almost like a religious system with that higher goal of communism. And it almost is like, you know, he's almost like describing himself, I guess, in a way.
Right.
With the opium of the masses, you know, how much, you know, communism, socialism, that sort of thing has kind of just like, you know, gripped a lot of people's, you know, attention, thinking that this is the glorious, you know, thing to escape from all of my troubles.
Correct.
And I think it's the exact same thing that he's describing about religion, which is very, you know, strange.
But it's different than opiate is more of a depressant. Like, you know, if you have a heroin addiction or opiate addiction and you have the supply, you just lay about and you just are consumed by the drug. But he has a different kind of effect, which is, like you said, to distract from your daily life and certainly to blame someone else, the other, on your predicament, and I think he's very useful to a lot of people. That philosophy is very useful to say, well, you know, yeah, I started using drugs when I was 12 and I dropped out of high school, you know, as a freshman, and I've been committing crimes off and on for the last 5 years, but it's because I'm not, you know, I'm a failure, not because of the decisions I made since I was a preteen and teenager and young adult. It's because the man keeping me down. And it's very, it's beautiful in its perversion of reality and very powerful stuff. And that's why I detest him so much, is because it's so effective in leading people astray from being successful, productive people. Because if you follow this philosophy, you're either, you know, the vast majority of them are going to be subjects. Yeah. The few that are successful at it are going to be the people that rule over the masses.
Absolutely. And moving on to Kierkegaard, and he has a completely opposite view as Marx, really. He believes that religion is the summit of human progress, that the religious sphere is superior to science and politics. So it's really the best thing that humans have ever done, really, is religion, particularly his Christian beliefs. I believe he was a Christian, of course. I think he's Danish. Yeah.
Right.
And so then he goes on to kind of talk about Abraham and Isaac. And I know we've talked about this in the past in the podcast.
Yeah, I was surprised. You know, I've often thought about that story of Abraham, you know, almost murdering his son Isaac, and I'm surprised there are so many references to it throughout the history of Western philosophy. I guess it kind of pulls the same issues that, well, anybody who studies the morality of God,
yeah,
has to wrestle with that story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I
yeah, a little background on the story for anyone who's not familiar, of course. God told
Abraham. They're not familiar with it. Huh. Anyway, go ahead.
God told Abraham basically to bring his son Isaac to the top of a mountain and sacrifice him to God. Right. And of course, Abraham follows his orders, but right before he's about to kill his son, you know, God intervenes, sends an angel, and tells him to stop.
Right.
And that's basically the crux of the story. And the way Kierkegaard kind of goes about kind of explaining this, how this is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
He says that Abraham's act transgressed the ethical order for the higher end of the direct command of God. So it was an unethical action to try to, you know, kill your own son, but that doesn't matter because he moved into this higher plane of ethical code, which is basically just the will of God, the word of God, whatever he says.
And it really borders on ends justifies the means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, if God told me to do it, then it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Or I mean, it's a really fascinating argument that he's more moral because he's disregarding his own morality
mm-hmm.
for a higher purpose.
Yeah, which is...
Yeah, I mean, it's probably the only good way to try to explain it so mm-hmm. that it doesn't look like he's just trying to commit infanticide.
Yeah.
And that God was like, oh, I really want you to do this. Oh, no, just kidding. For the last second. I mean, literally, he's bringing the knife down. And the I mean, imagine the pressure on that angel. hold it. Because you know, it's not that God struck him down or mm-hmm. anything. And, you know, and Anthony Kenny talks about you know, other tragic heroes and that type of thing, and other you know, history of mm-hmm. religious thought and that kind of thing. And he mentions that if you were could be a more standard religious a religious figure, he would have stabbed himself mm-hmm. instead of killing his son. It'd be a tragic
figure. You know, self-sacrifice.
Right.
For the, yeah.
And I was thinking the same thing.
I guess in a way, you know, according to Kierkegaard, it would almost be still a self-sacrifice to sacrifice your own ethical code for a higher purpose.
No, because it wouldn't have been the higher purpose because God told you to kill your kid. Well, you didn't do it. You killed yourself, you stupid son of a bitch.
No, I'm saying that what Abraham actually did still would have been a self-sacrifice, according to Kierkegaard.
If you would have carried it out.
No, even if... Well, yes. Right, yes.
Right,
yes.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
But if he killed himself, it would be disregarding the
yes.
God's
order. So that would not be a self... That would be almost...
That would be a sin because...
Yeah, that'd be selfish of him, I guess, right, according to Kierkegaard.
Right.
That's very interesting.
As a father, I just don't, get any of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's just no way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if that's what God thinks is the right thing to do, then I'm not following him.
Mm-hmm.
As well, it was another philosopher mentions, what was the quote I underlined?
I do not know. I cannot read your
book. Oh, I can't. It was this. It was John Stuart Mill.
Oh, well, we're not there yet.
I know, but he said, hold on. I will find it.
Oh, my God.
I will find it.
Everybody has stopped listening. Our listener's gone.
Our listener is waiting with bated breath.
Yeah, he's very interested.
Or it was a discussion about hell. And and he says, and if such being can sentence me to hell for not so calling him, to hell I will go.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. I'm going to hell. If God says you got to kill one of your kids just because I said so,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to give him a big F you.
Kierkegaard kind of tries to explain this a little bit more, and he kind of talks about the leap of faith. He says the leap of faith has to be taken in blindness. You really can confide in nobody but yourself, because only you will really know if God is speaking to you. And then he kind of goes on to say that, you know, faith cannot be based on objective history because historical research is never concluded, and faith must be passionate, and it has to be full of devotion, and it must, you know, completely involve detachment.
Right.
So what he's saying here is we really can't look to historical proof of Jesus and that sort of thing to justify our faith. You know, if we're going to believe in God at all, it has to be completely blind, essentially.
Right.
You know, we can't look at his history. It just has to be within ourselves.
And he also talks about the passion and that you have to have, that even if the object of your of what you're going to do is infinitely improbable, you mm-hmm. should still have this passion and the faith to go forward with it. And Kenny makes a good point about mm-hmm. well, how do you know what's just what you're thinking it should be as opposed to the will of God? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people that have murdered a lot of people, because they thought they were on a mission from God.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, not everybody's the Blues Brothers.
Yeah. I was thinking the same thing.
But, you know, evidently Kierkegaard thinks that Abraham was, and of course our Bible says.
And I really disagree with Kierkegaard here. We're just talking about, because I think a lot of, there should be a lot of reason applied to your faith. I don't think it can just be complete blindness to history and that sort of thing. I think there are a lot of, proofs for God and that sort of thing, just, within, our worldly experiences and our logic.
There's a reason to believe.
Yes.
In addition to a passion to believe.
Yes. Exactly.
I agree with that. I still wrestle with this old a lot of the Old Testament stuff is tough for a modern Christian to kind of stomach, the eye for the eye and that kind of stuff. It's difficult. Sodom and Gomorrah, when the whole town was crushed, but the thought was, well, they're all evil. Well, what about their kids? There wasn't a single person there. What about the old lady who couldn't get out? There's got to be somebody that's innocent in there. But be that as it may.
Yes.
Old Testament God was a judgmental God. And I'm not exactly opposed to that, but I think you got to get it right.
Yes. Moving on to the theism of John Stuart Mill. So John Stuart Mill was very interesting in that he was raised completely without religion.
Right. It wasn't unusual at that time.
Mm-hmm. And it's almost unusual. Almost unusual still now, because it wasn't so much that he was discouraged against religion, he was just never taught about religion.
Right.
He just had no experience of God, and it wasn't so much that his parents taught him to be atheist and not believe in God and Jesus and that sort of thing.
Well, I think most people now...
Well, I guess, America, the more I think about it...
Well, and more so in Europe, except for the migrants they have going now, don't belong to any religion, but they would consider themselves... most people probably consider themselves Christian... or theists, without a formal religion, and only a minority of people in America even go to church.
Yeah,
time for another great spiritual reawakening. I think that's actually true. I think we're due for it because it comes in waves.
Yeah.
Historically, great waves of religious reformation and all that kind of stuff in American history.
Yes.
Anyway.
And so then he really kind of goes on to describe, what an omnipotent being would actually do and whether or not, why a God would even allow evil into the world. And he says an omnipotent being doesn't need sort of the means to the end, kind of the argument by design where he's talking about here with humanity. If he's purely powerful, he could just create everything good and create everything as it should be. And, there would be no reason to kind of go through this sort of design process and that sort of thing.
Right.
And then he also says that any omnipotent being that permits evil cannot be benevolent. If you have the power to make everything completely good and you don't use that power, then you are not good yourself.
That's a good argument.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I tend to think that God's more hands-off than most people think God is. Because if God's interceding on a regular basis, then why isn't he interceding when a 5-year-old kid gets murdered?
Yeah.
It's like, come on, man.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of, I definitely agree with the simplest world sort of belief, or, the sort of the best possible world, sort of a mix of those two in which, God doesn't control everything that happens. He just sort of set everything in motion, and that's how it goes from there.
But then again, I still pray,
So
it's kind of inconsistent.
But oh, well.
I guess it's not a waste of time.
Yes. I guess not.
Because if God doesn't answer your prayers, or as Garth Brooks... wisely said once, sometimes, what is it? Oh, come on. Their greatest gift is unanswered prayers.
I do not know.
Mm. Did I ever tell you the story? I'm going down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, and you've been going on.
You can feel it. You can feel
so many rabbit holes.
I had a dream that I won the Powerball.
Okay.
Like this huge Powerball. Well, this is a scenario that that this life that I'm living is an answered prayer. Because I won the Powerball lottery, and I had this dream that I won the Powerball lottery, and of course we moved into a nice house. We had more money than we knew what to do with. I was doing my own thing. Your mother is doing her own thing. We traveled independently. She ends up having an affair.
Oh my God.
Leaves me.
This is an in-depth
dream. You get addicted to drugs and commit crimes and go to prison. I forget which one of the other, your brothers ended up dying. It was horrible. And I am about to eat a bullet and I pray that I can go back in time and tear up that lottery ticket. Never buy the lottery ticket. And then bam, I'm at Quick Trip. I get my soda. I look at that Powerball number and the guy asks me, do you want anything else? And I say, yeah, no, just the soda. And I go off onto my happy life because God answered that prayer, but I never really knew it, although I knew it in my dream.
Huh.
And so
I have never told me about this.
I take that to heart because I think it could be so much worse than what it is now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't understand. I mean, of course, if you suffer from clinical depression, you know, you have depression or whatever, but I think that's a real struggle. But I think a lot of people think they have it a lot worse than what they do, and it could always be worse. No matter how bad it is, if you work at it, it gets better. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of my theories. And then I had you know, one of the most disturbing dreams I had.
Oh boy.
And I have a hard time telling this story without crying.
Oh my God.
Yeah, this is a tough one, so to get myself centered. And I'm not a crying person.
No, you're not.
But this was the most vivid dream I ever had. So as you get older, and you'll have these dreams when you're in your 20s, but like I used to have dreams all the time when I was in my 20s that I'd be back in high school, mm-hmm. and I couldn't find my class schedule, and then all of a sudden I'm wearing pants, or, you know, yeah. like, you know, like an embarrassing situation. But this one was, I went back into, so when I had this dream, I was married to your mother, of course, and we already had Sam, mm-hmm. right? But you weren't even born yet. I had this dream. And, so I somehow went through some sort of time warp and I was back in high school. I was me with all the knowledge I have about life and fashion and what's cooler and what's not. I was not a cool kid in high school. But it was me in high school. And so I'm like, oh God, these clothes are terrible. So I make a lot of changes. And all of a sudden, I'm like one of the cool people because I'm not sweating the small stuff. Mm-hmm. And I know what's going to be cool. And so I'm like ahead of the curve. And so then anyways, and I'm seeing my buddies having a great time because I haven't, you know, a lot of these people I hadn't seen in you know, regular basis because I were all in families and stuff at that point in my life. But then I noticed that at first, you know, I know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But then subtle things start changing, and over a period of weeks, events aren't happening the way they happened the first mm-hmm. time, and then I'm like, I really miss Rebecca, my wife, and Sam, and then it starts to dawn on me, I'm changing reality, and I can't get back to them, I can't see them now. Because then I'll even fuck up the time. I can't see him because he didn't mm-hmm. exist yet. So now I'm going to screw up the timeline. So I can't go visit her. I have to revert back to the dork I was and suffer all of the indignities and the mediocrity that I lived. And when I met your mother, it was a complete dumb luck situation mm-hmm. Where a buddy of mine hadn't seen this guy in months. Yeah. And he calls me up on a random Wednesday and says, hey, I'm going to Mizzou.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go on a road trip. And because I'm in spring break, I said, I'm not on spring break, but okay. So we all load up my car and we go to, and then I end up meeting your mother through a wild series of events. And so I get to that day. So I know what that mm-hmm. day is. And I've done everything that I think I can do to make all the same mistakes and suffer the same problems. And the phone rings and it's him. I hadn't talked to him in a couple of months, and he says, hey man, I'm on spring break. I'm like, yes, boom, boom, boom. Everything works out. I have to court your mother the same way for years. Cause we dated for 6 years before we got married. And then she gets pregnant. Mm-hmm. Sam's on the way. And then I go,
what?
So I go to the doctor's appointment and it's a girl. And it's, Sam's gone. And that was the worst dream I ever had, you know, because he didn't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I think maybe you had been born because then I thought about you too, because then, we already had you because then I thought, well, you're next. And then and that's it. And, mm-hmm. And it was just so disturbing. So anyway, the point of the story is that you shouldn't wish for something different.
Yeah.
And it could always be worse, of course. But I don't know how we got into that that whole thing. We're about
John Stuart Mill. I don't know how we get there.
But anywho, well, I told the first story.
Oh, why
first.
God allows evil in the world? Right. And, you know, if he was truly good, everything would be good.
Right.
So I think that's how we got
there.
Because it's like, you know, it's wishful thinking. You wish everything was good, but you know how much.
Oh yeah, that's how we got there. Because I had the dream or the wish that I the prayer. They answer prayers.
Yes.
That's how
we got there. Yes.
And so and there's a song by Garth Brooks about, you know, sometimes the greatest gifts are unanswered prayers, because sometimes you pray for something, and that's not what you need.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some logic to that. But that he wouldn't intercede on some things, but I don't know. But then again, was it John Stuart Mill had said, it was him that said, some would not find comfort and not sadness in the thought that they would not be chained through eternity,
mm-hmm,
in their conscious existence, which I never even thought of that before. Yeah. So if you go to heaven, or have an eternal existence, maybe that's not what you should want anyway.
Yeah. Kind of says, you know, there's a possibility we'd almost be better without religion at some point.
Right.
Or we'd feel like we were, because we'd almost crave, you know, death more than immortality.
Right.
Is what he's saying.
Right.
Which is...
Well, a lot of people get that, mm-hmm, that point in old age or in really serious illness where you're like, oh, you know, the end of the suffering. You know, the sweet release of death and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Yes. Now, moving on to creation and evolution. So this is kind of where we get into Darwinism, with evolution, of course.
Right.
And Kenny kind of starts out by saying, you know, a lot of Christians do nowadays accept that the Earth had existed for billions of years and that sort of thing, and how that's how we've gotten here. You know, it's not, you know, the original, you know, 6,000 years of existence that Christians used to believe. But he kind of says, you know, the hard part to reconcile is then original sin, because in the biblical story of Genesis, it's original sin that actually causes death at all. So, you know, if you're following the Bible, you know, how do you reconcile that with evolution and Darwinism?
Right.
And so he also then kind of goes on to say, you know, just because, you know, you believe in a God doesn't mean that or Darwinism doesn't exclude the possibility of an intelligent creator existing. And Darwin even kind of says that at some points. He says, you know,
absolutely.
Well, you know, there's no reason why God couldn't have put evolution into place to get us to the point where we are today.
Right.
I think I've mentioned that.
I think it's more the, what he calls the neo-Darwinism, mm-hmm, Darwinists that are atheists and try to just say, well, we're just an animal and there's no God and there's, mm-hmm, no eternity and all that, which is interesting. You know, it's a compelling argument.
Yeah.
It's a very logical argument. And then Kenny mentions, well, there's three things they can't explain. I think I tend to agree with two of them, but I don't agree with the first one. Maybe you do,
mm-hmm,
which is language.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why he thinks that the creation of language is not somehow explainable through the theory of Darwinism, which you can evolve a language over time. And, mm-hmm, and obviously there are many languages in the world. And
well, it's really,
and if the United States was really determined, we could wipe out whole peoples. I mean, not that, you know, that we're omnipotent or whatever, but, you know, I mean, we could wipe out small peoples' languages and eliminate it from,
mm-hmm,
existence.
The difference, like what you're talking about with the existence of a language as complex as ours, is really the complexity of the language. Because, you know, we see like apes and that sort of things. They can like learn basic sign language to express, you know, the present, basically.
Right.
But you can't, there's really seeming, as far as we understand it today, there's really no explanation to how we get into the vast complexity of language as we have it today. Because it's like, you know, with everything else, you know, with nouns, you know, person, place, or thing, I can point to an apple, say apple, that is apple.
Right.
And, you know, at some point I can, you know, point at I can say apple, and you can assume that I want an apple. But then it's for things like, you know, prepositions, or you know, conjunctions.
Yeah, but
you can't point to an if.
Right. True. I mean, but that's just an intellectual complexity,
mm-hmm,
and I think it's stipulated that humans are more intelligent, and have a better capacity for complex thought. So why wouldn't their language be more complex than birds, who use a form of language mm-hmm. to communicate, or dolphins or whales who communicate, or other mm-hmm. animals? I mean, other animals communicate through grunts and whistles well, yeah. and whatever noises.
So but I'm not articulating it properly. But it really boils down to the abstract, you know, elements right. of language. You know, it's, you know, you can't really trial and error your way through that, really. And that's
I think you could if you just there's a lot more variables, mm. you know, because the evolution of the human race is really tied into language and the ability to communicate, and then more importantly the written language mm-hmm. And to store that knowledge and share it from generation to generation is what caused an explosion of wealth and prosperity
yeah.
over the last however many years. But mm-hmm. anyway, I'd found that the least convincing of the three. And then mm-hmm. the origin of life is the next one. And then the origin of the universe. Mm-hmm.
He says, you know, kind of the neo-Darwinists kind of try to point to, well, you know, the very, you know, I don't know the words I'm looking for, but basically like the atoms colliding and that sort of
right,
thing
right.
and like electrical impulses. And that's what gives life.
Origin of life. Mm-hmm. There was protoplasm, and then, you know, there's some sort of electrical impulses in the mm-hmm. you know, because the chemical reactions, and it created the most basic singular cell life, which developed yeah. into, you know, two cell life, etc. mm-hmm. etc. etc. I mean, that's the argument.
But Kenny kind of points out, you know, there's really no proof of that, you know. Correct. how do you say, you know, it was these electrical impulses which caused everything, because we can't right. really tell that at all,
right? How do we know it's not God's finger going
mm-hmm. And he kind of says yeah. the same thing about right. the origin of the universe, you know.
I think they have a harder time with that
mm-hmm.
because how and why.
Yeah.
When and where?
I know kind of the popular, well, I don't know if it's popular or not, but I think one of the biggest arguments now is that it's infinite. The world right. is infinite, and then it kind of moves in a cycle of, you know, expanding and then contracting and
correct.
Expanding and contracting.
But, you know, there's no why.
Yeah, there's no why.
Right.
There's no original right. point from that starting either. You know, right. how do you start that infinite cycle is also right. the question.
Yes.
Yes.
And there's really no explanation for that.
Mm-hmm.
One way or the other, definitively, scientifically get it.
Yeah.
But then you're just kind of left with, well, it just is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, God just is then.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and that's all we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you had a kind of a lengthy discussion of the Darwinists and their theory and doing a good job of explaining it, and also the weaknesses of it, that it's persuasive to a point, but then they have certain assumptions too.
Mm-hmm.
So
now moving on to Newman's philosophy of religion. And he really believes that faith is belief in a proposition on the word of God.
Right.
Really, there's nothing more to it than that. That is the base definition of faith. And he kind of goes on to say, you know, how do we know that, you know, God even exists at all? You know, why do we have to prove that? And he kind of says, you know, we really don't have to prove that in this very, you know, logical, formal way. He just kind of says, you know, it's, I don't need proof and evidence that London still exists every second of the day. And it's kind of that same way with God.
Right,
you know, I just
right.
kind of assume that he exists and I am right because, you know, London still does exist day after day and God still does exist day after day, according to my faith. And that's how I live my life.
Right.
That's basically what he says there.
Yeah, it's kind of just a reason why you should believe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that he has a convincing argument that you have to believe.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
Nah, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're all very good reasons why you should.
Mm-hmm.
And then he doesn't he talk
well,
about
Kenny
the conscience
kind of,
and all that mm-hmm. stuff?
Kenny kind of says, you know, it's very unconvincing for somebody who doesn't already believe.
Correct.
It's convincing for somebody who does believe and
right.
might be like leaning away from the faith.
Right.
And that's where it really brings people to him.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
Kenny
is useful, very useful,
mm-hmm. yes.
I think. To read him. I gotta read some of his stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Cardinal Newman also just points out the flaws in his own arguments. He doesn't shy away from that. He's
right.
like, well, you know, this is equally probable for all religions. There's nothing
right.
exclusive about this to Catholicism or to Christianity. He says, you know, it's just my faith that makes it Catholicism. And he also says, he really kind of hammers home this point that a believer may investigate arguments for and against their faith without weakening their belief.
Right.
And he really thinks
right.
that's very, very important as well. It can actually help improve your faith, help improve your belief by looking at these other arguments that aren't necessarily, you know, theological or Christian or anything. Just look at these different arguments to expand your knowledge of your own faith.
Right.
And I agree with that
if
very
much.
If
you're not willing or able to do it, then your faith isn't really strong enough to withstand
mm-hmm.
the challenge.
Yeah.
Truth.
And so then you were kind of mentioned earlier about his talking about the conscience, and that's kind of one of his big proofs for God. He says, if we commit a bad action, you know, we feel something bad within ourselves. We do something good, we feel good about that, and there's no other explanation for that really besides God. You know, we can't really explain that away other than, you know, God put that conscience within us.
Yeah, I don't really buy that.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, how does he explain sociopaths?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are people that that really don't have those kind of conscientious thoughts, or whose conscience would, their little inner voice would say, murderer, killer. You know, that type of thing. I mean, there are people that think that way. Well, what does that mean? I mean, if there are people that are evil, that have those thoughts and don't feel guilt or remorse, what does that say about the existence of God and his theory? Well, we either all have it because it's like a seed from God, or none of us have it as a seed.
Yeah.
Or he's planting some bum seeds in something. You know? Well, I planted a weed in that garden.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I didn't think that was... Yeah. What do you think about that?
I don't think that's too convincing, especially for somebody who doesn't already believe in God.
Right, you know? Right. Well, you have a conscience. God put that there. Oh, really?
Yeah. That's, you know, I think I've mentioned this before, but that's really where I have a problem with, you know, the evangelists basically saying, you know, well, it's in the Bible.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't matter to an atheist. You know, it's like telling me to read the Quran, and that'll be all the proof for God that you need. It's like, well, I do not care. That's not my religion. And I think that's a big problem with, you know, I think a lot of modern Christians is that, you know, they're so, well, I don't know if it's a big problem, but it's a problem that I've noticed in some places, is that they're so sure of their faith that, you know, the Bible is proof enough for them,
right?
But they don't recognize that that's not the same for everybody else.
Right. That's a real hurdle for the evangelical Christian sects, because they came up within that world.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bible is not a source of authority to people who do not believe.
Yeah.
And that's tough to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's why there's faith and not knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a different word for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have some certainty of belief without scientifically proven knowledge.
Yeah.
And that's really what faith is, in my opinion.
And then Kenny also mentions Frege again here, I thought this would be interesting to point out, because this is almost exactly what you said before, and he talks about the ontological proof for God's existence, which goes back to Descartes, you know, if I can even, you know, conceptualize God, then God must exist, you know, according to these properties of his existence and stuff. And Frege says, you know, this proof only gives properties to the concept God, not God himself, which is, you know, basically word for word what you have been saying, you know.
Yeah, see?
There you go. You're smarter than Frege. You did it before him.
Well, no, I did it after him. I just didn't do it. I did it without
his you were unaware,
I was unaware of how brilliant it was. we talked about that at the beginning of this whole thing, is that it's hard to come up with a truly unique philosophical argument for anything, because as you can see, over the centuries... anything that you would have thought of, arguments or counter arguments, have already been thought of and written of and studied by hundreds of people already.
Exactly.
Kind of depressing.
Well, now moving on to, well, I guess this is original thought here, because it's Nietzsche.
Yeah.
You know, if nothing else, he's original. And he goes on to talk about the death of God, and how religion has survived today. And he, you know, very famously said that God is dead. But what's interesting about this is he's not kind of saying this in any sort of, you know...
anti-God sentiment.
Yes, he's just almost evangelizing it, saying that now we have more freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, now that, you know, we've surpassed the need for God, we've surpassed the need for religion now, and now we have the freedom to live, and God was really that greatest obstacle to our freedom, and now he's gone. And then he also says that, you know... he has a big problem with a lot of other philosophers, these Christian philosophers, because they like to take bits and pieces of their Christian belief and apply that to their big philosophy. And he says, well, that doesn't work at all. You know, and none of the Christian belief works if God is not real. And of course, he firmly believes that God is not real. So he just completely discards any of the information of Christianity.
Well, and what he really seemed to be aggravated by was people who were no longer Christian, but they wanted to still evangelize for the Christian moral philosophy and system of morality. Well, it's, you're either a Christian or you're not.
Yeah. He has a big problem with saintliness, of course. What he believes is kind of the weak attitude as opposed to the strong. And he says that life ends where the kingdom of God begins. Mm-hmm. So as soon as you try to start following Christianity or any of these other major religions, that's when your freedom really ends. That's when you become this weaker, you know, lesser version of a person. Which
interesting cat.
He's unique.
Yeah.
And the only person who really took all of this to heart was this guy named William James.
Yeah. I remember reading about him years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Thought he was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. And he kind of takes a lot of Nietzsche's beliefs in a very different approach, because he says that the saint is the highest type of person abstractly, but it's completely impractical to live as such today. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe in a perfect world we could all be these saints, but nowadays, you know, this saintliness is not any values that we should really hold dear.
Or we can, really, practically speaking.
And he also kind of goes on to say that the arguments for God's existence have just significantly weakened over time. He's not able to completely just disprove all of these, but he kind of goes back to, you know, Aquinas' five proofs for God's existence, and he kind of just says, by the mere fact that, you know, hundreds of philosophers over the years have tried to poke holes in it, that's just systematically weakened it overall. You know, there's a little hole here and there, and now it just doesn't really hold up at too much at all anymore. And then... let me read my notes here. You're very conversational right now.
Let you roll on the William James. Mm-hmm.
And he also kind of poses this question when he's kind of talking about, you know, why do we, you know, attribute things to God? Why do we give him properties? Because he says, you know, what difference do God's metaphysical attributes make to our lives? You know, why do we care if he's omnipotent? Why do we care if he's omnipresent? You know, it doesn't matter to us. You know, why do we care if he knows everything, or why do we care if he can do anything? That just doesn't apply anymore. And then he also says that feeling and not reason is the source of all religion. You know, religion is basically completely fueled by emotions. Anybody who really follows a religion really isn't using reason at all. It's really very much just their emotions.
Right.
But then he also kind of says, you know, even though religion is completely, you know, ludicrous, essentially, he says, you know, there is...
I don't know if he's saying that,
but... he still says that prayer should still be recommended for people, if nothing else than for therapeutic purposes.
Right.
You know, it helps your kind of mental state to believe that there is something out there, even if it is, you know, there is no good reason to believe, it still can help.
Well, and the way he defines it is prayer means every kind of inward communion or conversation mm-hmm. with the power recognized as divine.
Yeah.
Whether it exists or not, I mm-hmm. guess, but yeah.
He says that religion really only has value in the individual. As soon as we try to like apply it universally with sort of a code of ethics dependent on the existence of God, then he says it really all just falls apart.
Yeah, what do you think about that? I think there's some truth to that. That it's most useful and most pure in an individual. Once you have it in a structure, you know, I guess it's more human frailties imposed upon it. I'm thinking of the bureaucracy of the Catholic Church, but that is probably more of a unique issue that we have with the corruption and all that kind of stuff.
I think at some point he's kind of correct.
Yeah.
That sort of inward belief is probably the most helpful to an individual person. But I think if you just completely leave everything up to whatever you believe, that's when you start to get into the really bad false ideologies. And that's kind of what we were talking about earlier, you know, well, I think God is talking to me and telling me to kill all these people.
Right.
And I think that's where we lead into that. You have to have somebody to kind of outside of you to step back and say, hey, that's not what God would do in any of these other instances.
Right. Yeah.
You know, you kind of have to have that check on the individual desire or individual craziness.
I guess you'd end up with moral relativism where it's like, well, everybody has their own religion.
Yeah.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yes.
But I guess it makes sense that you'd evangelize for your particular belief system, and if you have more than one person that has the same belief system, you've just formed a religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, essentially.
Know. And so I guess if it benefits you, you'd want it to benefit somebody else, and so then you convert them to your view, and then you have a religion. Isn't that better? Isn't that better that both of you have gotten that benefit of that philosophical belief and faith in God? If it was good for you, it should be good for everybody or as many people as you can convince to go along with it. And so therefore, isn't that a better good than just the good for the individual?
I would say so.
I think I just refuted William James.
Good job.
Yeah, thank you. We should have a bell in here. So every time I've defeated a philosopher who is not present in an argument, I can go ding.
Well, unfortunately, this is the last episode. We didn't have time to put a bell in here.
That'll be season two.
Yeah, that'll be season.
You'll Mark, lose. Mark debates dead dove.
It'll just be you saying things, and then yes. We'll have like a minute and a half of silence for them to respond. Oh, you just snatched your head. Oh my God.
I guffawed and hit my head.
Moving on to Freud on religious illusion.
I think William James just sent me a message from beyond and hit me in the head. That's kind of spooky.
So Freud really believed that religion is an illusion. It's completely undetermined by any evidence, and right. We've basically just made it up to fool ourselves.
Yeah, just a psychological argument against religion.
And he says that you can't really refute religious claims at all. You know, if I went up to a religious person and told them to just stop believing because X, Y, and Z, that doesn't work. But it still would be better if religion had just withered away. That'd be the best kind of result for everybody.
You know, it's kind of funny. If he would just left it at that, it'd be a lot stronger argument. But then he has this whole theory about the creation of religion with the old hordes of people.
Yeah, he basically said that, you know, in the past we lived in hordes, and there was always one man who basically enslaved all the rest of the men. Right. And religion started, according to Freud, when the slaves banded together to kill the primal father, this, you know, enslaver, and establish taboos against murder and incest. Which is almost crazier than Nietzsche. I don't know.
No, Freud's crazy, and the again supports my theory that all psychologists and psychiatrists are nuts, and they went to that field to figure out what's wrong. Freud proves it.
He had so much wrong with him that he had to basically invent the entire field of psychology.
That's right. Yes. Cuckoo.
Yes, which is just, I don't know where you would even come up with that. That's just like, I think this is how history happened. And yes. Yeah.
It's, and he didn't die. Whatever. Moving along.
Philosophical theology after Wittgenstein. So Wittgenstein...
I like this quote. Can I interrupt you?
Yes, absolutely.
The quote that he wrote in his notebook, is to believe in God, he wrote in his notebook during the First World War, means to see that life has meaning. I think that's wise words.
I do think so. Mm-hmm. But he was very conflicted on his, according to his own beliefs on faith, kind of after that, he kind of bounced back and forth, it seems a lot during his life, to whether or not he really believed in God. Because he says that faith is really not based on historical truth. I'm going to read this section here.
Oh, the whole thing? Go ahead.
It's like four sentences. He says, Christianity is not based on a historical truth. Rather, it offers us a historical narrative and says, now believe. But not believe this narrative with the belief appropriate to a historical narrative. Rather, believe through thick and thin, which you can do only as a result of a life. Here you have a narrative. Don't take the same attitude as you take to other historical narratives. Make quite a different place in your life for it. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, and that it's not so much, especially nowadays, the Catholic Church is almost starting to teach that, you know, the Old Testament isn't meant to be taken literally in many instances.
Yeah,
they've said that for many years. Yeah, you're right. It's that, you know, it shouldn't take the place of a history book. You know, it's meant to more teach us how to live a life rather than to be, you know, this is how it happened.
Right.
Essentially.
Right, like a historical text.
Yes.
Yeah.
He also says that only faith can give meaning to life and not philosophy or wisdom. That's the really only thing that can give life meaning, you know, no matter how much we try to find reason and try to find, you know, wisdom and knowledge and that sort of thing. You know, that's all well and good. And that can be part of your faith. But faith is the only thing that actually can give you meaning.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I also like this quote where he says, don't be afraid of talking nonsense, talking about religion or philosophy. But he went on to add, you must keep an eye on your nonsense. Moderate your nonsensical talks.
He also says that the proposition God exists is neither true nor false. What he kind of means is by that is, you know, you really can't prove it either way. No matter how much you argue about it, you know, no side is going to convince the other because there's no way to really prove one side correct unless, you know, you travel to the beginning of time.
Or the end of time.
Or the end of time and see if there's a God or not. That's really the only way to tell if God really exists, according to Wittgenstein.
While you're alive.
Yeah. Yes.
We're all going to either know or not know.
Yeah, that's true.
The time we die. Oh.
Jesus, you're just knocking into things. Then we move on to this guy, Alvin Plantinga.
Never heard of him before.
Yes.
It's the first time I ever heard of this guy.
And he kind of brings up this idea of maximal excellence, and this is kind of how he tries to prove that God exists.
Which I don't think is that much different than...
It's very similar to the ontological argument. Right. And he says that, you know, if we believe that God has maximal excellence, which is, you know, a property that includes omniscience, omnipotence, and moral perfection, then if God exists really in any world, then he must have maximal excellence. But
in all the possible worlds.
But then he must also have maximal greatness, which means he has maximal excellence in every possible world. So what he's kind of saying here is, you know, if we have infinite worlds and God exists in one of them, then he has to exist in all of them. So if there's a way for him to exist anywhere, then he exists everywhere.
I think that's true.
I think so.
Depending on how you define God, but mm-hmm. I think the concept of God, as I understand it, the creator of all things, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why that's...
It's a very convoluted way, I guess, to get to his end point.
The same thing.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, anyway. That was the last guy in there. That was the last philosopher for season one of Unlimited Opinions.
Yes. Well, I like the how the book ends. Mm-hmm. However you say his name, Plantinga's restatement of the argument, using logical techniques more modern than any available to Russell, Bertrand Russell, serves as a salutary warning of the danger that awaits any historian of logic who declares the philosophical issue definitively closed.
Yes.
It's a good way to end a book on the history of philosophy.
Yes.
We're never going to stop talking about this stuff.
Yeah.
We're never going to have a definitive answer.
And, you know, us individually are never going to stop talking about this stuff because there will be a season two. That is a...
Yeah, we're going to have to figure out what we're going to do on this.
Yeah, we still have
no
idea. You can tweet ideas at us.
Yes.
Capital U, lowercase LMTD, opinions with a capital O.
Have we gotten a tweet yet?
No.
How can we have not gotten a tweet?
I don't know. Our tweets aren't seen by hardly anybody.
Well, do you follow it? Don't you have to follow people?
I guess I probably should follow people.
Yeah.
I don't follow anybody. Or I think maybe I follow you.
And I don't ever interact with anything on social media.
So I guess I should follow more people. I can check like how many people actually see each tweet if you want me to do that. Really
I make my social commentaries rarely on Facebook, but I have private settings and I have less than 150 friends.
You used to have more. I know you've cut back.
Oh, I used to have almost 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went through a series of culling.
It just make you so angry to read like anything on your Facebook page, I remember.
On my Facebook?
Well, not
on
your... Yeah, yes.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess I'll be feed. Like, well, maybe I came down to, you know, I have friends, you know, mm-hmm. people I've known for years. And then I started thinking of them differently because the stupid crap they put on social media. And then I was like, they're still the same people and they're good people. And so my attitude was changing about people because of their private thoughts. Mm-hmm. They put in their diary online is really what it was. And I'm like, you know what? And they really made me delete a lot of friends was because they would say something broadly insulting to people who shared my beliefs mm-hmm. or my political affiliation. It's like, but I knew they didn't mean me.
Yeah.
But they said me
mm-hmm.
and it would make me angry. I'm like, okay, I don't even want to know, you know, let them scream into the wilderness. I don't need to hear it. And that has really been great because the only people that are on my social media are very close friends or family, and not all the friends mm-hmm. and not all the family. And then people who I know agree with me almost 100% politically.
Yeah.
So it's like, because then it's not that I can't handle people saying things that are different from mine. Cause I get sources from all their news sources and I understand I could be wrong about anything. It's just the insults, mm-hmm. the personal insults, the demeaning comments of people that I know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what really bothered me. I'm like, well, I don't even want to know.
Yeah.
You know, go insult somebody else. If somebody insults me and I don't know it, I'm much better than if somebody insults me and I know it.
Yeah.
And that was the hardest part about running for office is that you see all these comments of people about you because, you know, I'm a relatively private person and all of a sudden people are saying stuff about me and most of it negative. I'm like, God, you know, that's a real downer. And so, you know, I don't even know how Trump put up with all that stuff psychologically
mm-hmm.
Or really any politician.
Yeah.
That's why I think half of them are crazy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure especially when you get into the higher level politics, the amount of money that they get is more than enough to.
No, I don't think that. I think they all have something wrong with them. Was it Mark Stein? I forget who it was. Some commentator. No, it was Tucker Carlson. I seem to have been mentioning
every
episode.
Mentioned him like, the past three episodes.
This is now the third one in a row for sure. His theory is that all national politicians are trying to compensate for their absentee or alcoholic father. One of the other.
Wow.
And boy, there's a lot of truth to that.
Really?
You go into the history, personal history of a lot of successful politicians, there is a gap there from parental love and almost always the male father figure.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
It's kind of spooky. Well, when you get into politics, even I dabbled in local level, you find that the really successful ones are ones, well, in order to be successful in politics, it has to be your life. Mm-hmm. It has to be not only your day job, but your hobby and your religion, because it requires that kind of effort and interest and investment. And so normal, well-adjusted people are not that interested in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not that interested in politics in order to devote the time and energy necessary to win even a regional political race.
Yeah.
Let alone the investment that you'd have to go into a congressional district or a senatorial campaign or a presidential campaign. There's something else going mm-hmm. on there. Because they all talk about how
it's almost obsessive compulsive.
Yeah, they talk about how narcissistic Trump is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just because I think they see themselves in him and
yeah.
they hate themselves for what they do. And he's no different than them.
Mm-hmm.
Anywho. So, yeah.
That's why your big plan is to just get nominated into a political position and fire everybody.
I don't want to be elected anything.
Yes.
I want to be appointed, not nominated.
Yeah, not nominated.
First half of it. No, I don't want to fire everybody.
Yeah, not everybody, just the ones who do not do anything good.
It's
an oversimplification.
First of all, it's an oversimplification. I said, and that was a private discussion.
I'm so sorry.
Now it's on our podcast, so our listener now knows. That my theory is that I'm temperamentally prepared to be the person responsible for a great culling of unnecessary employees within the federal government. Meaning, like if an entire department or 50% of the employees are not productive in mm-hmm. the department, I could be the person that would go in and get the job done.
It's a great plan.
Well, I'm just waiting for that job opportunity to open itself up, because you know we all have talents, and the real challenge in life is to recognize your talents, your capabilities, and your weaknesses, and find a pursuit that satisfies you and you can accomplish great things doing what you can with what the talents you have. That's some good advice.
I think that's some good advice to leave season one of the podcast on, unless you have any other comments.
I'm sad that this is coming to an end.
Yes. So
yes.
Am I.
Yeah,
we'll be back into it soon.
We better be back into season two. We got to figure that out, because
yeah.
if we wait too long, we'll never do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you want to hear more of us, you better tweet us ideas, because we don't know what we're doing from here on out.
I have a couple ideas.
Do you want to mention them here?
Well, I mean, we can, I like the idea of using a book as mm-hmm. A jumping off point. I think the next one, maybe not such a thorough book.
Yeah. Cause, I mean, for a little background, we tried to start a podcast,
yes.
you know, quite a few times. I know we had like
a couple
at least
episodes.
Four-ish,
yeah.
I think,
but
we could never keep up with it. Yeah.
Right.
Cause it was just completely, you know, what are our thoughts on this? And we didn't have anything to keep
right.
us.
So we
centered.
Need really, almost like a table of contents or something that we know which episode is going to be before we have it. We don't give it any thought. And this one, we just follow this book. But I think mm-hmm. if we have a book that,
I don't think we were expecting this book to be so thorough too.
When we ordered it, I didn't realize how many pages.
Yeah,
it was.
When it arrived, there were these two like cinder block sized books sitting on our counter.
I'm shocked. I never imagined that we would actually get through this book.
You think so?
And have this many episodes.
Really?
When you
first saw the book?
I didn't think it was going to go more than a couple episodes anyway.
Really?
As busy as the two of us are, And quite frankly, I just viewed it as an excuse to have an hour long uninterrupted conversation with my second son, the second born son, not in order of importance. So I'm like, all right, I'll do that. And it's about philosophy, and I can talk about philosophy.
Yeah, we made it work. We only ever missed like 1 or 2 weeks when I was out of town. Everything else has been pretty well scheduled. Yes. We hit every week.
We changed the day, you know,
a couple times,
especially when I was working in the house and stuff. So. Yeah, I think we can keep it going. I'll have to get some equipment so we can do it remotely or whatever. And I think if you come home, we can do it live here. Mm-hmm. If I go on a road trip up there, I think we ought to do it remote location up there somewhere, which I think would be entertaining.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
But I like the idea of trying to figure out people to interview or be part of the podcast as well.
I'll be at college. There's all kinds of interesting people there.
Right. Either other students or even faculty members. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can make it a highbrow deal. And, you know, if you're interested in the local people here, I'm sure I can make arrangements. I'm not sure. I could probably make arrangements with some of them to give their thoughts on various subjects. But we would need to have like a format.
It'd have to be very structured. So we can't just, you know, invite somebody in and just start asking them random questions, of course.
Well, we could,
but we should have a little bit more structure than that.
I guess. I mean, but some of the best interviews are when you don't really know much about somebody, but it takes time.
Yeah,
it takes time to get to the subject. But like Joe Rogan's podcast is terribly entertaining, and a lot of it is just freeform stuff. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he prepares. But, I mean, of course, he goes on. He has unlimited, so he's talking to somebody for 3 hours.
Yeah.
So he probably has, you know, a handful of subjects he wants to talk about, and then they just talk, and they just follow where the conversation goes. And sometimes it doesn't work, but most of the time it does.
Well, that's just a little, I guess, teaser for what might come in the future.
Our first guest for season 2 will be Joe Rogan.
we have contacts with Joe Rogan.
Yeah, that... not that Joe Rogan.
Who do you think? This is Joe Rogan from Festus, Missouri. I don't know what you're talking about.
On the street.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Joe Rogan.
All right. Well, this has been season 1 of Unlimited Opinions. I've been Adam Bishop.
I'm still Mark Bishop.
We need you to sing.
Only friend, the end.
Okay.
That's the Doors.
Yeah, I know. That's the Doors. You were singing that the other day.
We should play that out.
Should we? I think we will get copyright struck.
We'll never know.